Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
I am adjacent to the City of Champions, Los Angeles, California, the City of Champs. Now, you may not agree with it, you might not want to take my word for it, but if you still need more evidence, check out Aaron Rodgers, of all people, and what he dropped on Twitter, some SoCal love, and I quote, Max Homa. That's the tweet. Hashtag City of Champions. End of tweet. All right, so we'll get to the zip code gloss in a minute, but why don't we start with the dude that Aaron Rodgers just name checked, Max Homa. You know Max. Max went to hell and back this weekend and ripped some incredibly impressive hardware in the process at the Riviera Country Club yesterday. The Genesis Open is the final act of the PGA Tour's best coast swing. Best coast. And it's a hell of a closer, right? It's where Tiger Woods made his professional debut. The same track where Steve Elkington went legend and ripped a major. And it's where Max escaped a certain golf death twice in about a half hour. You probably saw it, but if not, let me help you. Coming down the 18th fairway with the iconic clubhouse in the background, Max needed a birdie to win. And after a picture-perfect drive, he stuffed a green light special inside 3 feet to set up what was a mere formality. At least it looked like a mere formality. It should have been a mere formality. This was going to be the defining moment of the 30-year-old's golf life. Remember his backstory, a product of Valencia High School. He cut his teeth at Griffith Park Muni. He grew up coming down to Riv every year to watch the pros from the gallery side of the ropes. As a kid, he grew up on this event. The hometown hero was about to rip the hometown event, only to have this happen.
Oh, he did go middle and it did move.
Absolute witchcraft. A 3 foot lip out on the low side and the biggest gag job of the year so far on tour. And man, because I love the guy, absolutely love the guy, hated to see that and hated to know, man, I'm gonna have to talk about this early and often because I love the guy. Now, so many other dudes would have mentally melted down right then and there and come unglued on their way to a sudden death playoff. And frankly, nobody would have blamed the guy if he did. I mean, who's going to come out of that? Especially since he just invited Tony Finau to come off the range and play one more that Finau had no business playing. And that big dog was up for it too. Because on the 10th tee box of the world-famous short par 4, Finau piped one pin high just off the left side of the green. Like, there's position A, and then there's that drive. Perfect. Just perfect. Then Max was next, but he tugged his left into the tree line, and the CBS broadcast revealed that Homa's rock was in the worst place imaginable. Stymieville, USA. If you've ever played golf before, you know there's nothing worse than getting to that second shot and realizing you have to play back sideways just to get back to a spot where you have a forward swing in the direction of the green. And that's what it looked like for Homa, who was sitting against a tree while Tony Finau was sitting pretty pin high. In other words, this one was over before these dudes even got off the box. Except Max kept his cool. He didn't blink. And he imagined one of the most creative shots you're ever going to see. Because what this dude did was take a 60-degree wedge, shut the face down completely, took the steepest half backswing, and made the cleanest contact to somehow get a deliberate hook shot onto the green.
What a cool shot.
Oh, that's a heck of a shot there. Tremendous from Homa.
What a cool shot is right. Tremendous. After the lip out on 18 and the tree lie on the playoff hole, two of his last three strokes were the unluckiest you could ever imagine. Yet again, he did not blink. He did not flinch. Instead, he saved the most unlikely par while Finau chipped on and missed a birdie to win. And then at the second sudden playoff hole, you had a feeling that Tony had just missed his chance again. And you want to talk about a hard luck guy. You want to talk about a guy who's come close so many times. because Max was out there doing his best Matrix impression, just dodging bullets left and right. And that feeling came to fruition finally because Finau dumped his tee shot on the par 3 14 into the bunker while Max threw a dart just beneath the stick. Homa cleaned up a par. Finau missed a sand save. That was that. Thanks for coming. And just like that, after 74 holes and a couple of disasters that would have wrecked almost anybody else, Max Homa is your 2021 Genesis champion. And believe me, this meant the world to him.
What does it mean to you now to come back and win here?
Didn't hit me till just now. Sorry. Been watching this tournament my whole life, why I fell in love with golf. Wow, didn't think I'd be like this. Had good feelings this week. Been playing great. City of Champions now. Dodgers, Lakers, me now. So it's a weird feeling.
Atta boy. That was tough. That was very emotional. And he said it himself, I did not know that it would feel like this. I didn't know I'd be that overcome. But we are talking about the City of Champions, and this is where this guy grew up. A dude who grew up coming to Riv as a kid, who just won a second PGA Tour event in his own backyard where he used to watch the other pros do it. And that's why Aaron Rodgers dropped that City of Champions gloss in his tweet, because Max dropped it in that Greenside interview that you just heard. So Aaron was responding to that, and they're tight. A couple of Cal guys. My guest is Rick Barnes. Rick, it's been a minute or two since we last spoke. How are you doing? How is your life right now, Rick?
Hey, Jim. Good to hear your voice. You know, we're doing fine. It's been a year, I think, we've all kind of gone through where it's been up and down and a lot of uncertainty. And right now with our team, you know, we've been very inconsistent the last couple of weeks. And you expect a little bit of that early in the year, but not this time of year. But the whole year has been inconsistent. Overall, you know, these guys have worked hard and tried to work through all the different issues we've had to deal with this year and just need to finish strong.
It's good to hear your voice too, Rick. Rick Barnes joining us. All right, so why don't we jump right into that? You dropped a tough one, Rick, to Kentucky on Saturday. How do you go about processing that particular loss and then getting ready for Vandy on Wednesday?
Well, you know, the difference in the game here and there, Josiah James played a big role in our win up there. You know, he had a double-double up there, and we didn't have him in the game here, which kept us from maybe spreading out a little bit more than we were able to do Saturday. And Kentucky shot the ball well in the first half. They really shot it well, and we didn't really have a great shooting game at all. And I thought we started pressing. You know, we have two young guys that, you know, have been spectacular at times, and they've struggled at times. And they had 50 points against Kentucky up there. They didn't fare so well this week. We knew Kentucky would do exactly what they did, crowd the floor, not to give those guys a chance to play one-on-one like we were able to do up there with them. And I just thought we got anxious as a team, and when shots weren't going in, we just kind of got away from what we needed to do. And our inside game, our post game that you need to have on days when you're not making perimeter shots, it just wasn't there.
Rick Barnes joining us. Rick, I wanted to ask you about those two young guys that you referenced. Why don't we start with Jaden Springer? He arrived, for those who don't know, as a freshman as part of a class that generated a lot of buzz. And in four of his last five games, he's put up 23 points, 30 points, 21, and 16. So what do you make of the way he has shown up as a freshman?
Jim, you know, it's interesting with Jaden, and Keon was falling into this too. You know, and I think any young player this year, freshman for the most part, they've had as much a difficult year to get settled into college basketball because they didn't have the full summer, the full fall, the way you like to have with them. And Jaden fought some injuries in the fall, and so he really, really didn't get himself going to where he needed to be from a conditioning standpoint until somewhere in the middle of January, really. And nothing that he could do other than go as hard, and he was going as hard as he possibly could. But, you know, we also, because of the COVID shutdowns and stops and starts, it affected the young guys so much more than it did the older guys, as you would expect. I mean, the older guys have been through it before and could pick up things and move on quicker. But I'm sure we're not the only team that's dealt with those stops and starts. And you felt like almost every time you're doing the same thing as a team, and with young players, you couldn't move as far as quickly ahead as you wanted to, trying to keep them up to speed to where they needed to be. And there's a lot we didn't get to put in this year. We haven't been able to just because of where we are with our starts and stops.
Are you feeling stressed out? Probably so. Most people are. Listen, don't let the stress of daily life weigh on your body. Whether you're an elite athlete or somebody like me, just trying to make it through the day tension-free, Theragun can help. Theragun is the handheld percussive therapy device that releases your deepest muscle tension using a scientifically calibrated combo of depth, speed, and power. And it's as quiet as an electric toothbrush. This product is incredible. The Gen 4 Theragun doesn't just feel good, it gets to the source of the pain by releasing tension. Using Theragun's signature percussive therapy, which goes 60% deeper than vibration alone. Whether you want to treat your muscle tension from working out, or maybe you have an injury, or it's just the stresses of everyday life, there is no substitute for the Theragun Gen 4. Theragun is trusted by 250 professional sports teams like Real Madrid and elite athletes like Paul George, DeAndre Hopkins, Maria Sharapova, hundreds of thousands of customers, and myself. I have mine. I absolutely love this product. Try Theragun for 30 days, starting at only $199. Go to Theragun.com/Rome right now and get your Gen 4 Theragun today. This product is sensational. Go to Theragun.com/Rome right now. Get your Gen 4 Theragun today. The product is absolutely amazing. Once again, Theragun.com/Rome, R-O-M-E. Theragun.com/Rome. Rick Barnes joining us. All right, so we talked about Jaden Springer. You mentioned Keon Johnson. So what you have, though, you've got some good young players, Rick, and you've got some coming in as well. In fact, there's a father of a player who's coming next year who said a big part of the reason that his son chose Tennessee was because of your history of developing players. You know, guys like Jordan Bone, P.J. Tucker, and the like. I'm curious, when you're looking for guys that you think might fit what you're trying to do, exactly what are you looking for? What kind of a player fits best with what you're trying to do there?
The guys, Jim, that fit best in ours, it's the guys that have that DNA where they are just eaten up with wanting to get better. Where they, you know, a lot. I think most people you talk to, they think their kids work hard. And I think kids in general think they work really hard. They don't really know what it is. They just don't truly understand what that next level work is about. And even from here to the next level is even more so. But we want those guys that are already they, and that's why during the recruiting process we are brutally honest with how we go about things, and we want those guys that say, hey, I want it, I want to come in, I want to work, I want to be the best I can be. And guys that really buy into that are the ones that have the success here.
You know, I would imagine, Rick, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that P.J. Tucker, I know for a fact now, obviously, he knows how to work. He understands this concept of next-level hard work. He wrote, though, and this is a big P.J. Tucker house. I love the guy. He said, quote, I came with the hunger, but you showed me how to fine-tune it to become a beast. How did you go about fine-tuning that hunger with him and helping him maximize his potential? What was your time like with him?
Well, you know, Jim, when you think about P.J. Tucker, you know, he grew up in North Carolina, right, you know, Raleigh area, and was not recruited by any ACC school. And you got four of them there that were in a, you know, they could touch him as much as they wanted to, and wasn't being recruited. I think maybe UNC Wilmington might have been recruiting him, and Frank Haith from North Carolina. And he had told me about him. My college roommate was still coaching at Lenoir Ryan where I went to school. And I called John, and I asked him, I said, tell me about P.J. Tucker. He said, all I can tell you is everybody says he's overweight. He's not tall enough. He says, all I can tell you, he always wins. He always wins. He said, I don't care who he's playing against in this state. The best players that are all these, you know, great players, suppose he always wins. And when he came, his very first workout at Texas, he couldn't make it. I mean, he really, first individual workout, he literally was on the side of the floor. He had thrown up in a garbage can. He was laying there, and he called his mom and said to his mom, Mom, I can't do this. He said, I thought I could. I can't. And the next day, first of all, we found out the reason being he had not eaten all day. He, you know, really on his own for the first time, going to classes, hadn't eaten. And the next day, Jim, he came in, and it's like somebody had totally flipped the switch. He got going, and the one thing you realized early about him, one of the most fierce competitors you've ever could be around. And I told him, we were talking a year or so ago, I'd read an article where he had made up his mind when he was overseas playing, you know, I think he what, spent 6-7 years over there. And he came out at a time when the NBA was just changing over. That, think about that team, the one that championship, I think, the year he came out, Tim Duncan, Robert Horry, and David Robson was a typical front line in that league. And when PJ came out, you know, he was player of the year. I used to get on him. I said, you got to work on your perimeter jump shot. And he would say to me, Coach, I don't need to shoot a jump shot. I can score on anybody inside, which he could. I mean, that was no joke about that. But he didn't make it. And he went overseas, and I'd read an article where he said he really wishes, you know, he had given up on coming back to the NBA. And I told him, I said, PJ, that's a lie. You never gave up on wanting to come back here. And then as the game changed and he came back, a guy, and people have no idea how, I mean, he was an amazing scorer in college, especially around the rim, which that game up there now is different than it was then in college, obviously, too. But you know what? He spoke with Grant Williams, and he said, you just got to do two things if you want to play in this league. He said, one, you got to accept a role. And he said, my role is playing defense and knocking down the corner three when I need to shoot it. But he changed his mindset. And I tell guys all the time, I mean, he was a guy that wanted to score every time he got the ball, for he is totally now a guy that's the ultimate team player. And he's always been about one thing, though, winning. Winning was always the most important thing to him.
That's an amazing response to me. Rick Barnes joining us. And, you know, my big takeaway from that, Rick, two things. One, mindset, right? Everything starts mm-hmm. with a guy's mindset no matter what. And number two, that point that he made when he first came in, that people were saying, and that he was in the North Carolina area. Any one of these big schools could have had him, but they didn't want him because he was overweight. He wasn't tall enough. But what you knew about him was he just won. He always won. How do you identify that? And what separates a guy who always wins from others who think they work hard and would consider themselves winners?
Well, that's a great question, because I tell you what, that's the hardest thing to figure out. Like, you, again, I can throw Grant Williams in there. Grant Williams from Charlotte, North Carolina, not one ACC team offered him either. But when I saw Grant Williams, again, overweight, you could tell he had a good feel. But one day I'm watching him, and I see him spin baseline and go up and dunk the ball for the first time. It looked like he put his elbow on the rim, which he had a guy, everybody said he's too small, he plays below the rim. And so my thought when I saw him was, hey, if he's got that in him, we just got to get it out of him more consistently. And that's why when you're out recruiting, you're watching guys, you might see him do one thing, and the question is, why don't they do it more? In most situations, they haven't been asked to do it more, or either they're not in shape where they can do it more. And so when you're evaluating those guys and you try to spend as much time with them as you can to talk to them and just totally generate the conversation to talk about, hey, are you willing to work? Because, you know, you are overweight. I mean, when you're recruiting a guy and you want him, it's hard to tell him, hey, you're lazy, you don't play hard enough. And I will tell you this, my good friend at Davidson College, Bob McKillop, told Grant Williams that. He said, we're not going to recruit you at Davidson because you're overweight and you don't work hard. And when I sit down with him, you know, I said to him, I said, how does it make you feel when somebody's honest with you like that? Because I said, I'm going to be honest with you like that. And he just looked at me and said, well, he's right. And so when you got someone that can be honest with themselves, that's when you know you got a chance to maybe get something out of people more than they might think they have given.
Rick Barnes joining us. Well said. So, Rick, as you mentioned, the program had to pause activities back in November. There were a number of positive tests. I mean, it's so challenging. It's so different. Even you had a positive test. What was it like to go through all of that in that period yourself and with your team?
Well, you know, when mine popped up, that's when we had our you know, it was literally 3 days before the open of the season. And what was really hard for us is watching college basketball get going. And after going through the fall, you know, everybody's itching, ready to play. And then knowing that we're going to end up playing 10, 15 days later, whatever it came out to be, was really hard. But as I was going through it, I had a number of people reach out, one of them being Tom Izzo. Tom had been through it, and, you know, he had told me what he had gone through with it. And my first couple of days, it wasn't so bad for me. And he told me, he said, be careful around that sixth, seventh, eighth day. And to be quite honest, Jim, that's when it jumped on me to a point that it was probably, honestly, looking back, it was probably a little bit worse than I wanted to say it was. And I do think this, I really do think there's something to be said about COVID fatigue. I think that we're watching some players that have been good players that are struggling, that's had the virus. I think that, and I'm glad Jason Tatum came out and talked about that, because even though you get yourself going, there's some difference to it once you go through it. But it was a tough time for all of us here. And, you know, right now we're testing three times a week, and not everyone obviously has tested, you know, positive for the virus. So, it's scary every time you go in those 3 days hoping that that test is going to come back negative.
Why don't we talk some Mariners baseball? As I mentioned, kind of a rule of thumb when it comes to this show. If I'm talking about that team, then it's going to go badly for that team. Generally, it does. Otherwise, I would not be talking about that team because they never do anything right. They never do anything good. So if I'm talking about the Mariners and I'm talking about their president and their CEO, Kevin Mather, he probably did something really stupid. And then he and they are probably about to get wrecked for it. And if I'm talking about the president and the CEO talking to the Bellevue Breakfast Rotary Club, then it's going to go horribly for everybody. And that's pretty much the result of him running his yap to the Rotarians earlier this month. You see, he was speaking to the Breakfast Rotary Club on February 5th. Those comments became public yesterday and immediately went viral. So why is that? It's because he said the quiet part out loud and said so on pretty much every single topic imaginable. Like, you know the speech to the Rotary Club where nobody ever says anything noteworthy? You know it's an all-timer when you've got a guy like that having to issue a statement which includes the following line, and I quote, "I've been on the phone most of the day today apologizing to the many people I have insulted, hurt, or disappointed in speaking at a recent online event." End quote. Attaboy. Stay hot, champ. How the hell could anything that happens at the Rotary Club go so horribly that you have to spend a day apologizing to all the people that you've insulted and hurt or disappointed? I mean, how dumb would you have to be? How bad would that speech have to be to warrant an apology like that? A statement like that from the CEO of an MLB team? The answer? Really, really dumb and a really horrible speech. The hell was this guy thinking anyway? Clearly he wasn't. My man's mouth was simply on autopilot. Check out what he said. How about that stuff about the fact that he admitted there was no way the team was going to call up their top prospects last season? Not because they weren't good enough, but because the team wanted to manipulate the service time.
If our major league team had had a COVID outbreak or, you know, injuries, and we had to call people up from the taxi squad, we were a little short on players because there was no chance you were going to see these young players at T-Mobile Park. We weren't going to put them on the 40-man roster. We weren't going to start the service time clock. There were all kinds of reasons that if we would have had an injury problem or a COVID outbreak, you might have seen my big tummy out there in left field. You would not have seen our young players, our prospects, playing at T-Mobile Park.
Check this dude out. I'm going to gloss over the fact that a grown-ass man, an adult, just used the phrase, "my big tummy," in public. I mean, normally that'd be one of the more offensive things in a speech like that. It doesn't even crack the top 10 here. And honestly, the fact that he's openly admitting to being happy to putting a lesser version of his own team on the field in order to manipulate service time isn't even the most egregious offense from this dope. I mean, we already know that goes on. We already know that a bunch of major league teams do that. But this moron is the only one admitting it in public and going on record with it. Except he wasn't done. He had more. Like saying that Kyle Seager is, quote, overpaid, and that this would be his last year with the team. Like, that's cool, I guess. I'm not saying that Seager has been lighting the world on fire, but maybe you don't hop on a Zoom call with the Bellevue Rotary Club and put one of your key players on blast like that. And he wasn't done, not by a long shot, because he had some thoughts that he wanted to get off his chest about the second-ranked prospect in the organization, Julio Rodriguez.
Julio Rodriguez has got a personality bigger than all of you combined. He is loud. His English is not tremendous.
Oh, good take, bro. Good take. He's got a huge personality, bigger than all of you, but his English is not tremendous. Yeah, I'm sure that's not the first time you've said that, and I guarantee it won't be the last. But first, he had more that he wanted to say about Rodriguez. Because why merely irritate? Why merely irritate one of your best prospects when you can go in on him and really piss him off?
Everybody says 2021. He won't be here till 2022 or 2023. A fantastic kid. Really big on social media. He loves to get out in front. He loves the Mariners.
That's a tremendous approach, right? Everybody says, we'll be calling this guy up this year. The hell we will. Maybe next year. And you know what? Maybe even the year after that. Let's make sure we keep on sucking before he gets here. I mean, why bring him up? He might help us. And I love that he chases that with, quote, a fantastic kid. Really big on social media. He loves to get out in front. He loves the Mariners. Yeah, I don't know about that, big dog. I'm not so sure about that part. He loves the Mariners. I mean, maybe he did. Maybe he had until you got in front of the Rotarians. Because no sooner than that speech went viral, Rodriguez, because he's, quote, big on social media, was tweeting a Photoshop of his face on Michael Jordan's body from The Last Dance with the caption, quote, and I took that personally, end quote. So he's already pissed off Kyle Seager and his family because Seager's wife Julie tweeted, quote, so should we put our house in Seattle on the market now or... Nice job, Julie. Good tweet. And as if Mather had not already shoved both his feet into his mouth and hadn't already done enough damage, he started cramming in the other limbs in a hurry. Check out this great section on dealing with diversity in his organization.
For instance, we just rehired Iwakuma. Iwakuma was a pitcher for us for a number of years. Wonderful human being. His English is terrible. He wanted to get back into the game. He wanted to, and he came to us, and we quite frankly want him as our Asian scout interpreter. What's going on in the Japanese league? He's coming to spring training, and I made the statement. I'm tired of paying his interpreter because when he was a player, you know, we pay Iwakuma X, but we also had to pay $75,000 a year to have an interpreter with him. His English suddenly got better. His English got better when we told him that.
Man, this dude is just obsessed with people's ability to speak English, right? He's like, wonderful human being, but his English was really terrible. Yeah, really insightful take, Mather. Let me ask you something, Mather. How's your Japanese these days? Because you're definitely not a wonderful human being. And while your English may be wonderful, you're using it to torch your career and make your club a laughingstock. Well, a bigger laughing stock than it already was. Something that I didn't even think was possible. Man, and how cheap, how petty and how cheap would you have to be if you're bent about having to spend 75 grand so one of your key players can talk to his teammates, his coaches, and the media? Like, the rap on the Mariners organization is they suck and they spend as little as possible and they're not interested in winning and they couldn't figure out how even if they tried. It's the organization where careers go to die, and guys can't wait to get out of there. And after listening to this guy, if you didn't know before, now you know why. That's why they suck, and why guys don't want to be there. And by the way, he's talking about this guy arriving in 2012, nearly a decade later, and he's still crying about spending 75 grand to pay for an interpreter so a player can talk to his teammates and his coaches. And I don't know, maybe... assimilate, get comfortable, help that team win? Dude, you're crying about 75 grand that you spent nearly a decade ago? And there was more garbage, like stuff about parking garages, how the team is making money, general bullcrap. This is an organization that is celebrating the 20th anniversary of their last playoff appearance this season. An organization that has not been relevant for decades, literally. Nobody cares about that club. And now you're proving exactly why that is. Because you're a major league club with a single A mentality. Imagine having the arrogance and audacity to talk like this when you're Kevin Mather. This isn't exactly Brian Cashman with a stack of rings. Or Theo Epstein. Or anybody else you've heard of or associated with winning something. This is Kevin Mather of the Seattle Mariners. And this dude's out here styling and profiling in front of the Bellevue Rotary Club like he's someone who's actually done something. And by the way, it's not like it's the first time this guy's gotten in hot water either. Before he was team president, he and two other team executives were accused of inappropriate workplace conduct by multiple women, accusations that resulted in financial settlements. And now you're taking shots at your own players. Now you're bragging about manipulating their service time. Now you're complaining that you have to pay for a translator. I mean, to quote another Seattle legend, for who? For what? To impress a dozen or so Rotarians? I mean, what's this guy going to do when it comes time to impress the Elks Lodge? Burn the stadium to the ground? How about that brunch? How about that brunch speech to the Knights of Columbus? Man, that's going to be so lit. Look the hell out when he starts talking to the Shriners.
It's lit!
I would call Seattle the West Coast Mets, but they're not even that. I mean, the Mets at least have a brand of sucking and being an embarrassment. They've perfected that. The Mariners don't even have that. Like, they don't matter enough for anybody to waste any time clowning them. How can you clown something that doesn't really even exist? Or you forget they exist. Now, I'm not even calling for somebody's job. That's not my style. But the fact that the Mariners employed this guy and promoted this guy and still have this guy around in the position he's in tells you everything you need to know about him and them. One thing to think bullcrap, quite another to say it out loud, and still another to say it to folks in public who are in no way affiliated with the team. And still another to think that you can say crap like that and that it's going to stay in that room. I mean, I literally can't believe that in 2021 I have to make this statement. I still can't believe that I have to say this, but literally anyone who has a phone, in other words, everyone, is a reporter. So if you wouldn't say something like that to a reporter, then don't say it to anybody at all, because everybody is one and everything is on record. I mean, did you try to go off the record with the Rotarians? You can't ever go off the record. With life, all it takes is one, and there is one in every single room. So if you're a public figure and you do or you say something really stupid, chances are somebody will have video of it, and then we'll all know. That's your room, dummy, not the Rotary Club. How could a CEO of a major league franchise not know that at this point? Again, bad enough to think it, but even worse to say it in public. Know your room. Know your room. Your room is not the Rotary Club, dummy. It's the Mariners doing Mariner type things.
Seen my big tummy out there in left field.
Big dummy? Oh, you see my big tummy out there. This big tummy's full. This big tummy's full of milk. What embarrassment. You Mariner fans. How's that feel? How's that taste, Mariner fan? If there are any left. Are you craving some protein after a good workout? I know I am. Before, I did not have a very good plan, but I do now. Listen, do not make a shake. Don't eat a bar. Grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper instead. Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty, it's tender, and it's made from real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. And it goes wherever you go. Just look for Old Trapper. It's in the Clearview bag. That way you can see exactly the quality you're getting. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name, because I'm telling you, no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? KJ Wright is my guest. KJ, great to have you on. How are you?
Man, that is a great resume you just called out there.
Dude, that is an amazing resume, actually. In fact, I was going to ask you about that resume. It's good to have you. You just wrapped up your 10th NFL season, and you said that when you came into the league, you wanted to play 10 years, you wanted to win a Super Bowl, you wanted to be named to a Pro Bowl. You have done all that and more. So how much pride is there for you in achieving all the things that you set out to do?
That's special, man. I couldn't ask for a better 10 years, especially with a great organization in the Seahawks. So just, you know, winning Super Bowls and, you know, being Pro Bowls, and it's been a blessing, but I still got a lot more work to do. And, you know, I'm not done yet. I got to get 1,000 tackles before it's all said and done. I got to score a touchdown before it's all said and done. So I'm still rolling.
KJ Wright joining us. I figured there was some unfinished business there. You know, if you were to go back to the beginning, you recently were posting on Instagram some of the milestones from your career. Why don't we start with what you said, quote, shedding real tears when your mom dropped you off at the airport to fly to Seattle. What do you remember about that trip in that first year? What was that time like?
Yeah. Man, because, you know, I came during the lockout year, so that whole year was just crazy. I got drafted, but I wasn't able to come immediately to the team, so I was just sitting at home waiting for a phone call. And then the lockout ended, and coaches called me, hey, you got to hop on the plane tomorrow. And, you know, it just all happened really, really fast. And so my first time ever leaving home, and my mom dropped me off, and I was going across the country, and that was real emotional for me. And so it was a special moment, but I panned out just okay.
Yeah, it did. KJ Wright joining us. You know, one guy that you've singled out is Ken Norton Jr. as a coach who taught you what it took to play linebacker at this level. What did you learn from him? What were your biggest takeaways from Ken Norton Jr.?
Coach Norton is a legend, man. I remember growing up watching the Cowboys. You know, I was a Cowboys fan growing up, watching him and what he did throughout his career. And I remember meeting him at the combine, and him and Coach Carroll, and he looked me in the eyes and he was like, "I think this dude could be one of us." And so he probably said it to everybody, but I really believed it. But when I got to Seattle, man, he just really took me under his wings and just showed me how to be a pro, how to call the huddle, how to watch film, how to tackle properly. And so he's forever, you know, a father figure in my life, and I'm so glad that he's having success.
We're talking to KJ
coordinator,
right? Excuse me, KJ. We're talking to KJ Wright. You know, it seems to me, I was going to just jump in and say, it's one thing to show up at that level and learn how to be a professional and to play at that level, but it's entirely another to have to come back from adversity, come back from injury, put yourself back together. I bring that up because in your eighth season, you suffered a knee injury in preseason, and you had posted some of the images from rehab. What was that process like in coming back from that in a contract year and only being able to be out there for five games?
That season was a very, very low point for me. Just the way I got hurt, like I was just warming up and just a simple shuffle, and I tore my knee. And to get hurt during contract year, all the stress and anxiety I was experiencing, it was super tough on me. But I knew that I had to come back. I knew I had to come back and redeem myself. And that ninth year that I put up had career highs in tackles and interceptions. And so the rehab team in Seattle is amazing. And so it's definitely a team effort in getting back on the football field.
Hey, listen, I don't want to gloss over that. I think that, like, people hear that, and it's just one of those things, like, yeah, it was stressful, and there was some anxiety, but I did the work, and I came back, and it's all good. I'm trying to kind of put myself in that position. If I'm in a contract year, and I know how important it is, and then I suffer this devastating injury, and I suffer it the way you did, man, there's a lot of stuff to process. There's a lot of baggage, a lot of mental stuff going on. Like, how did you get through that, process that, and then show the kind of mental toughness necessary to come back and play as well as you did? How did you do that?
Yep. Because when the doctor told me, I was like, "Doctor, do you know what's at stake here? Like, I cannot get surgery. Like, I got to go out there and prove myself so I can come back." And I'm telling you, during that season, it was hard for me to sleep. I couldn't eat. My wife was like, whenever I came home, the energy just shifted in the house because I was honestly in a really bad place. But my support system, my wife was there for me, my teammates was there for me, and I just had to when I got back on the football field, that's when I was you know, much better. And so it was definitely a deep, dark place that, you know, athletes go through. But you just got to get all the injections you can. You have to get PRPs and stem cells and all that stuff to just get back on the football field.
KJ Wright joining us. I would imagine also, like, you probably allow yourself a moment or two where it's really dark and really heavy and maybe you're depressed, but, like, you got that switch, right? You got to throw that switch. It's like you got to get back in the fight as quickly as possible. Isn't that the key to it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you definitely got to take time to process what just happened. You got to definitely, you know, be sad. You got to be upset, be mad. But at the end of the day, you know, the champions always rise. You got to get knocked down and fight back. And so when you get injured, it's about being consistent, being persistent, and you're going to have some setbacks, but just listening to your body. You know, my body's telling me I need to slow down, but when it gets right, let's keep attacking this thing. And so that whole offseason, I was doing stuff to get right for the ninth year. And I put together a real good game plan, rehabbed my tail off, and you know, I had an awesome year.
And it was one of the career years. KJ Wright joining us. So what about that? That's the moneymaker, right? Both your mind and your body. Mm-hmm. How much do you know about taking care of your body and preparing for the game, both mentally and physically, now that you did not know when you first arrived in the NFL?
I'm telling you, this past season I hired a chef. And I'm telling you, that thing is life-changing. Just what the food you put into your body, especially in the off-season, that stuff goes a long, long way. And like, after the games, like early in my career, I would get super sore after the games. This year, I don't remember those super, super sore days, like on Mondays. And so I contribute that to what I was eating and putting in my body. And just, just the mental aspect, like, you know, every game, I just visualize success, you know, visualize making plays. And so I think all this stuff just transferred onto the football field. As you saw, this past season was just, a lot of people say it was my best, and I think it was awesome as well. And so just eating right, sleeping right, and just visualizing success on the football field.
I think that's amazing. So, like, what kind of fuel are you running on, and what are you eating that you feel so amazing and that you can recover that quickly?
Man, she got me eating all kind of stuff. It's just, I can't pinpoint exactly what it is. I know it's not, like, you know, fried food and all that sugar. The sugar intake is just good quality food that my body needs. I'm actually going to do, like, a blood test to see, like, what my body needs. You know how people do that?
Yes.
I'm actually going to do that this offseason to see, hey, what exactly does KJ need to, you know, take my game to the next level?
No, there's no doubt. People do that, and I've been looking to do that. I've been meaning to do that. I have not done that yet, and I know why folks do that. Hey, KJ, were you a sugar guy before? Was that your thing, or was it more like salt?
You know, I kind of, my diet was all over the place. It was a lot of sugar. It was definitely a lot of sugar, and you don't need it. The body doesn't need sugar. And so I had to get rid of that intake, and just, you definitely see your body transform once you change your diet. It's bizarre.
How much better? I mean, I'm asking you because it's personal. I agree. I'm kind of that guy too, and I fight that thing like a lot of people. How much better did you feel when you got off sugar?
It's 9 days. Like, even when you train, like, you don't get as tired, and you see your body just transform. And like I said, after the games, I literally was not getting sore. And so the recovery to get back to the next Sunday was way faster on the football field. And so I believe everybody should just definitely take a look at your diet. I'm not saying go vegan and just, you know, that crazy, but just watch your intake and what you're putting in your body.
Just clean it up a little bit. You are what you eat. KJ Wright joining us. I'm glad you shared your thoughts on that. So you and Bobby Wagner are the last two members of the Legion of Boom defense. What's it been like to play with him over the years?
Bobby's amazing, man. Bobby is just put together a Hall of Fame career. Just what he does off the field was amazing. You know, the guy negotiated a beautiful contract that he just signed last year. And so he's somebody that I love playing with. Anytime we're on the field, the Seahawks have a really good chance of winning the game. And so we've just been dominating over these past years, and he's somebody that I've always admired in the way that he approached it. You know, we trained together in the offseason, and just Bobby's a good dude, man, team captain, so I love him.
KJ Wright, my guest, I'll tell you another good dude, Jamal Adams. I had him on the show a few weeks back, and we were talking about the culture of the Seahawks, and he was talking about how much he loved coming in from the outside. Like, how would you describe that culture, and what's it mean to you to be one of the guys who sets that culture and is responsible for passing it on to guys who come in?
Yeah, man. I remember the first time I met Jamal. You could just see, like, how happy he was to come to Seattle. You know, throughout my career, people tried to resemble what we did, like, in our glory days, like when we was winning Super Bowls and playing the 49ers. People tried to resemble that, and everybody wanted to be a part of it. And so for me to just be a part of it and last 10 years with the organization and then bring guys in, show them how we do it, show them how we practice, show them how we just vibe together and get along and no egos, you know, that stuff is special, man. And so for me to be a part of the Legion of Boom and to bring these other guys in, you know, Quandre and Shaquille is balling, you know, it feels good to be a part of it.
KJ Wright, my guest for another moment or so. So you're definitely a part of it. You're a huge part of it, KJ, and you were there when that team was having tremendous success. You're still right in the middle of it right now. But as you know, it's a business. It's always going to be a business. So how important is it to you to continue playing with Seattle and perhaps even end your career as a Seahawk?
Yeah, I mean, that would just be a beautiful story. If I could just ride it all out with the Seahawks, you know, that's some legendary type stuff. And like I said before I left, I believe that it would be a great investment for Seattle to, you know, to keep me. Because as you've seen, since I've been here, we've been nothing but, you know, awesome. Always making it to the playoffs, you know, winning our division. And so they know how much I want to be here. But at the end of the day, I get it. When I've been looking at the salary cap, they got to, you know, clear some space to make things happen, and so they got to get busy.
So, I mean, what do you do? Like, for instance, I know the one thing you don't do, you do not talk. One thing you never do is talk about another man's money, so I'm going to talk about another man's money. Like, would you be willing to give them a hometown discount to stay there, or do you owe it to yourself to make sure you get fair market value?
No, man, I do way too much on the football field to take a discount. That makes absolutely no sense. Like, if you want to, you know, win all these championships and, you know, look good on Sundays, you got to compensate your guys that are making plays. And like you said earlier, nobody, you know, had double-digit TFLs and PBUs in the NFL. So I have a family, and I'm trying to, you know, set up long-term success for my family. So that's kind of the question.
Okay, respect. I respect how you answered that question. Absolutely. All right, so finally, you're obviously still hungry. You obviously have some unfinished business. You have some work that's still in front of you. I laid out all the things you've already accomplished. What is still motivating you right now? What are the goals still?
I mean, even Jim, with all this stuff that you said, all those, you know, accolades and achievements that I made, I still haven't felt like the world has quite felt me yet. I believe that there's, you know, even this last year, I wasn't nominated Pro Bowl. That pissed me off. That pissed me off. And I look around. I haven't even been nominated, you know, NFL's top 100 players. That pisses me off. And so I'm still hungry. I'm still out to prove, you know, how good I am, and I feel like my name isn't quite respected the way it needs to be. And so I'm about to start training next week and just get back on it, because, you know, I feel like I got so much more to prove in this league.
I feel like you're going to get what's rightfully yours, KJ. I feel like you're going to get paid, but I know another way for you to make money as a side hustle. If you could bottle what you just said to me, you could sell that and make a lot of money. I'd be the first in line to buy it. That's because that's what you need, right? No matter who you are.
Yeah. And so, man, I'm on a mission, and free agency is around the corner. And so, you know, I know a lot of teams that want my service, but I'm interested to see what that looks like.
There you go. Seahawks linebacker. He is already a Super Bowl champion and a Pro Bowler and an All-Pro, and obviously on a mission. KJ, I appreciate you very much. That was a great conversation. I'm glad you came on. Thanks so much for doing that. Great to talk to you.
Yeah, Jim, thank you.
So before the start of the NBA season, I felt pretty strongly that it was the Lakers and everybody else. Not only were the defending champs the team to beat, but I felt like they had widened the gap between themselves and everybody else because they had a really effective offseason. In other words, they had the potential to get better. There was no offseason for Rob Pelinka. He went to work on a few roster deficiencies that they had. He addressed them, and they did get better. They got better when they added Dennis Schroeder, Marcus Gasol, Wes Matthews. They ripped Trez Harrell out of the Clippers locker room. So the team that won it all got even better. And I still think this Lakers squad has got the same potential. Of course, pending Anthony Davis's health. If he's right, my take has not changed. If they get him back and he's right, and they don't burn out LeBron in the process, having him play extra minutes to keep this thing afloat, then they're still the team to beat. That hasn't changed. What has changed on my mind relates to the gap between the Lakers and the next best team in the NBA. What I'm saying is they do have competition now. And no, it's not from the team that shares the same crib with them here in LA. It's from the team that beat the Clippers last night, 112-108. And yes, I'm saying it. The Lakers are going to have to pack their lunch come time for the finals because it's going to be some work. They're going to need to work to beat the Brooklyn Nets. And they're big three. The Nets are title contenders. I would not have been willing to say that necessarily when the season started. I'm saying it right now. They are title contenders, whether you want to admit it or not. Yes, I did have concerns when they acquired James Harden. Yes, I did voice those concerns when they got Harden. But they've quickly proven that they are absolutely legit. I mean, like, there's offensive juggernauts, and then there's this crew. And this West Coast swing just proved exactly that. I'm well aware also of the fact that Kevin Durant has not played of late. I just don't care. You add a generational scorer who doesn't dominate the ball, and that's going to make that team a bleeping Voltron. Not take that away from them. Steve Nash has the big three in their best possible roles, and the role players, the guys surrounding the big three, are better than y'all think. Last night against the Clippers, without KD, Harden and Kyrie did exactly what they've been doing of late, balling. And the guys around them did their jobs as well, and they grind out that dub. I mean, the Nets were easily in control heading into the fourth, up by as many as 15. And while it looked like they were going to run the Clippers out of the gym, PG and Kawhi had other plans. Then all of a sudden, you've got yourself a game. So credit to the Clippers for hanging in. They're still chippy as hell. Even George. In fact, especially George. He's following up that horrid playoff run where he got glossed, Pandemic P, with some of his best ball to date. And in the fourth quarter last night, he was in full PG-13 mode once again. He scored 12 in under 5 minutes. He sparked a rally that cut their 15-point deficit down to 6 with only 3 minutes to play. It looked like they might rip that game. But this being just his second game back from a toe injury that had cost him 7 games, Ty Lue ripped him from the game after he had logged 32 minutes. Remember Friday night when he played his first game back after the injury, he played 27 minutes and said that he was not ready to play 30. So last night, he finished the last 250 on the bench. Hey, listen, I mean, as a sidebar, I agree 100% with a player's safety always being the first priority. Obviously, that's what the Clippers did here with George. I get it. You got to take care of that guy. You got to manage his minutes. He's coming off that injury. But I also agree 100% with fans who are annoyed by that. I mean, think about it. Most fans are turning into the NBA nowadays and not seeing a team's best product. In fact, the truth is with the association, now that it's out of the bubble, you never know what you're going to get night to night. You never know who's going to play night to night. You're not getting the best product night to night. And then you see a matchup like that, and the Nets look like they're going to run out of the gym, and the Clippers hang in, and it looks like they have a chance to rip it only to have a guy who's on fire on the bench. So that's not the best thing, obviously. The Clippers have their two horses out there in Kawhi and Paul George. And then he gets yanked with the game on the line. That's a pretty tough sell right now to the fans. And to gamblers like the Big Head. Anyway, I digress. PG had to finish the game on the pine. He had a front row seat for Kawhi, trying to tie that game with under 10 seconds to play when this happened.
Leonard drives, goes inside, lays it up, and an offensive foul is called.
An offensive foul in that situation. Yeah, I'd say that's pretty questionable. I could even argue that was a bad call. Harden seemed to initiate the contact. And to me, personally, that's a clear playthrough. A couple of strong dudes, couple of studs battling late in the game, nothing more. But the refs made that call. And then the Nets finished with another dub, and that's 6 in a row for them. And speaking of Paul George, you knew he'd have some thoughts on that Kawhi call and the overall officiating. Remember, 3 weeks back, after losing to the Nets the first time, George was not happy with the refs. And last night, he hammered that same point home.
I haven't really got into the flopping game, but in today's game, it's smart. You know what I mean? It's smart. They control the refs. You know, they got the refs in their pockets. So, you know, kudos to the guys that are great at that part of the game.
Yeah, somehow I don't think that's what he meant. They've got the refs in their pocket. They control the refs. Kudos to those gutless floppers who are great at being gutless floppers. Yeah, I don't know, Pandemic. I don't think the reason you lost was due to the refs and your perceived star treatment towards Brooklyn. Nothing like a dude who is a star and plays with another superstar in Kawhi Leonard complaining about somebody else getting star treatment. And if I'm George, the last thing I'd be doing right about now is complaining about what calls the guys in Brooklyn are getting. I'd be way more concerned about the actual guys in Brooklyn. As in, you just lost to two of the stars, and the third, who some consider the best player in basketball when healthy, didn't even play. I'd be a lot more concerned about that. A lot more worried about that than the way the officials called that game in the end. Because no ref is going to close that gap between them and your team right now, Paul. Brooklyn is just better than you right now. And if I'm everybody else in the association, I'd be way more concerned about that than the way the officials are calling their games. Look, they're not without deficiencies. Except those deficiencies are not as big as we thought they might be. I mean, sure, their defense is not great. But I would say their rebounding would be more of a concern for me. But don't forget, they've got time to correct that. And they're getting better. And the trade deadline's coming up. And they've got, for instance, Spencer Dinwiddie and his contract that they could easily move. He's injured now, but he is a nice player. He's only 27, and the team acquiring him gets the bird rights, which would be pretty attractive for any team getting him. And then you've got the buyout market. We all know everybody wants to jump on with a contender, and that's exactly what these Nets are. So, Laker fan, I would not take your car flags down yet. No need to panic yet. But make this very clear. I'm not saying that Brooklyn's better. I'm saying they're coming pretty fast, and they're closing the gap, and they're legit, and they are going to get better. How much better remains to be seen. We'll see what they do in the buyout market or the trade deadline, but they are getting better. And what I'm saying to you, Laker fan, you better hope that AD is healthy when the time comes, and you better have your A game come finals time. Because it says here, there is a collision course waiting now between the Nets and the Lakers and the Nets. Voltran offense is coming. Ice up, AD.
Ice up, son.
Ice up, AD.
AD, what's good, baby?
I was not buying earlier this season. I am now. Man, they are legit. And they're getting better. Much better. Kenny Moore the second. Kenny, good to have you back. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. Thanks for having me here.
It's good to have you here. All right, Kenny, I want to talk to you about the defense, of course, but I want to start with the offense because if we were to go back to last week when the news dropped, you immediately tweeted, quote, I'm about to FaceTime with Wentz. He better pick up. Congrats to Carson, end quote. So let me ask you, when you finally got a hold of him, what was that conversation like and what did you want to tell him about you, the team, and the culture there?
So first off, I was just being funny about the whole situation.
Right.
But because I usually – every time we get someone new in the building, I usually text, you know, Coach Reich or David Thornton here at the Colts, you know, what's this guy's number? I just want to say hey and congratulate him. Welcome to the family. And so just with that situation with Carson Wentz, I just wanted to, you know, just make it public. Like, hey, you know, this guy is a Colt now. So, you know, I just wanted to welcome him with open arms, you know, just like Colts Nation would do with anyone. So, that was just my whole thought process of everything. But, you know, I couldn't talk to Carson long because I was on a flight back to Indy. You can see the mask in the picture that I later included. And so my first text to him, I was just saying, you know, great to have you a part of the culture, the tradition. I know he know Coach Wright, but, you know, so many guys that's just like him that loves football, that like to work. And, you know, I'm just ready to leave with him. And, you know, we're all looking up to him, and, you know, the keys is in his hand. So he got back with me and said, hey, I'm about to pick that secondary apart. So, you know, he's already excited to play with us, and the feeling is mutual.
Kenny Moore the second joining us. I think that's cool. All right, so what kind of a message does it send the rest of the team that the front office was willing to go out and make a trade like that and get somebody like that and pull the trigger?
I mean, basically – They want to get a guy that, you know, all of us relate to. You know, whenever they're searching for a guy, there's not just the production that you play with and you can bring to the table, but it's more so like your character and how you, you know, carry yourself out of the building. How can you represent the shoe at all times? You know, just having that integrity, you know, when no one is looking. So just as a player and just an employee of the Indianapolis Colts, I mean – just from my experience being here, I trust this organization. I trust this, you know, front office personnel to get the right guys. So whoever they bring, they're family to me.
Kenny Moore the second joining us. What you just said about representing the shoe a certain way, like you and I have kind of talked about this in the past, but I'm really curious because I can hear it coming through in your voice. How would you describe the culture and the mentality in that locker room? What makes that different?
You know, everything is top down. So, you know, how we carry ourselves, how we go about things is more so a reflection of the people who brought us in the building. And shout out to Chris Ballard, you know, Frank Wright, you know, everyone that has a part of, you know, everyone that who steps in the building. So, you know, they want guys to be themselves. They want guys to have the personality to express themselves in the right way, but they want you to do the right thing at all times. So, you know, they just want guys who love football, who loves ball, who's self-motivated, selfless, who love each other, you know, but not scared to tell each other, you know, you're doing wrong or you can do better. So that's pretty much the tradition that we have and, you know, just love winning. And we know just from experience and, you know, just having flaws, we're not going to be perfect. We won't win every game. We won't go out there and do everything we're supposed to do. We're going to make mistakes, but, you know, just having that green light and, you know, from the coaches, you embrace your flaws, you embrace, you know, each other from the man that's to the left and right of you And, you know, that just gives us that camaraderie to love each other and get to know each other, you know, more so out of the building more than we do out in the building.
Kenny Moore II is joining us. You know, Kenny, you and I talked during the season, and we talked about the fact that you were not named to the Pro Bowl. Now that we're in the offseason, I'm wondering how that sits with you. For instance, I just had KJ Wright on, and he made it real clear to me, like, man, that's not all right. I'm not all right with that. In fact, I'm getting a lot of fuel from that. I'm feeling that. Is that how that feels to you, or do you just kind of move beyond it and ignore it?
No, I think KJ Wright, you know, a respected player in the league, great player at what he do year in and year out. I think he said it perfectly. You know, it doesn't sit right. And you know, that's pretty good for him to express, you know, how you feel. And because, you know, I think about sometimes, you know, because I could have just said, you know, it's okay, like, whatever it is. But, like, whenever I get home, you know, I lay my head on the pillow at night, I don't think it's right. You know, all of us as players, we put so much work in to, you know, get the achievements and, you know, not we all want this thing called a Super Bowl at the end of the year, and that's the ultimate goal. But, you know, us being humans and us being in this entertainment business, you wanna have those individual achievements, and you know, you just wanna glorify the Lord for all those achievements that He brings you. But you know, that makes me in particular, you know, have that chip on my shoulder. You know, just from not just not making the Pro Bowl All Pro, it's more so like this is my life. Like, I've lived this my entire life. You know, from being in the back of the line, or you know, working more to be more and to show more. But you know, that's just how it is. It's not okay. You're right,
Kenny. I wonder about that. Like, and I respect that so much, because there are certain guys that come up a certain way, and maybe they've got that chip on their shoulder, but then maybe they get theirs. Maybe they get that huge contract, and maybe they think, all right, man, I earned that. I could take my foot off the gas. That's not what I'm hearing from you at all. Mm-hmm. Do you think that mentality would ever change? Like, what happens when you get that ring? What happens when you get that big contract? Are you going to become that guy, or are you always going to feel like you're the undrafted player who's got to bring that chip every single day?
I'm always going to be that guy that has a chip on his shoulder, just because I can't help how, you know, my past have shaped me, you know, from playing 1 year of football in high school, then being told, you know, you're just going to go to college and, you know, see how things are, just be coachable and just play there, you know. But, and then in college, you know, you're the guy in the back of the line. You don't have much experience. You barely know all the rules of football. You pretty much just want to make your family happy. And then that passion from making your family happy, it turns into, you know, I can really do this, and it turns into a love for the game. So, you know, it's just that point. And then going to New England, you know, and being in a room full of guys who all can play, and every one of those guys can start in the league. But, you know, unfortunately, all these guys who can start anywhere in the league, they're all in the same room and for the same team. So, and then you see yourself on another team where you got to establish yourself and you're just trying to stay out of the way and work. So that's pretty much, you know, how things have been. So from going through those experiences and that adversity to, you know, being a, you know, top eight slot in the league, I mean, that's just not enough. I mean, I can't help how, you know, my past have shaped me mentally, physically, and, you know, just spiritually going forward.
Kenny Moore II is joining us. I would argue you certainly did take your game to another level this year. And did those who know, and they know what you've been doing on the field. And then you had that unreal pick against the Raiders that went viral. You and I talked about that during the season. Right. But does it feel like that's one play that can do a lot to get people to truly appreciate the work you've put in and what you're capable of on the field if they didn't already know?
Yes, sir. I think, you know, more so in this world, this entertainment, it really only takes one play. You know what I mean? Like, if we're looking at Odell Beckham, this guy made one play, but it was probably the craziest play we've ever seen, you know, from being held to, you know, DPI to a touchdown, a one-hand touchdown, fingertip, you know, catch, that spectacular, incredible catch that he made, you know, in his season, you know, that made him who he is. And you know, when I made that catch versus the Raiders, it was pretty much the OBJ catch. You know, so It really just takes one play. But I think more so in this league, or pretty much in sports in general, we got to appreciate more of the job, the task, the roles that, you know, the players take on. There's so many guys, you know, in the league, I guess, for the NFL, or for example, that is such a great player, but, you know, we don't really appreciate this player until he retires. And then we look back on the league and say, who else do we have? And you don't have anybody that's just like this player, like, you know, Tom Brady, Tyron Matthew, like these guys are, you know, Aaron Donald, like all these guys are guys that we got to appreciate, you know, each Sunday of watching them, respecting their craft and what they put in and put it out. So there's so many guys in this league that are respected by me first.
These guys that you mentioned are also, I mean, they're generational. These guys are Hall of Famers. Like, since you mentioned him, Kenny, like, Tyron Matthew is unbelievable. Like, physically, he's unbelievable with the intangibles. He's unbelievable in the way he leads and works and the plays that he makes. Like, when you look at his game, what do you think?
Tyron Matthew is everything I feel like any DB would want to be, like, or try to mimic, or, you know, just try to reflect themselves and try to, you know, look in the mirror like, dang, I just want to be like the honey badger. But, you know, the tenacity, the intensity, the knowledge, the swagger, the personality, his hunger, you know, that's a guy that has kept the chip on his shoulder because, you know, like I said, like, he's gone through so much from being kicked out of school and all his injuries and, you know, where he come from. And he played with that same emotion of how he felt, you know, whenever he went through those tough times to have a great game, try to watch, you know, whether it's on film, on TV, if it's before, say we have a night game or early game, I'm trying to watch him around the time that I have. So that's a guy that I just appreciate just being in the league with. You know, I want to be at the top with him. But, you know, that's a guy that I have tremendous respect for. It's all love with 23.
I was just going to say, I could tell how much you respect him. That's really high praise. Kenny Moore II, coming off a career year, a career-high 80 tackles, 4 for a loss. He had that amazing pick 6 against the Raiders, undrafted back in 2017. And as always, the future is bright. Kenny, appreciate you. Love having you on the show. Always like getting caught up and talking football with you. Thanks so much, Kenny.
Yes, sir. All love. I appreciate you,
man. All love, man. I appreciate you, too.
Good night now.